Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be looking at the philosophical underpinnings of science. Don't run away. Stick here. Because we're going to be talking about scientific reductionism. Now, we've done episodes before where we've talked about not just, you know, the fruits of scientific investigation, but the ideas that lie underneath what we do when we do science. We've talked before about that Daniel Dennett quote from Darwin's Dangerous Idea, where he says that, you know, scientists a lot of times think that philosophy is what those other, you know, navel gazers do over there, and that science is really free from all the constraints of that navel gazing, that they're immune to, quote, the confusions that philosophers devote their lives to dissolving. But what Dennett says is there's no such thing as philosophy-free science. There's only science whose philosophical baggage is taken on board without examination. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a maximum we should adhere to look at what's lying underneath science intellectually and always ask ourselves the question, like, is what we're doing philosophically grounded? Does it make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it gets down to the idea of to what extent can we truly just sort of mathematically, passionlessly break down things into their fundamental parts in order to make sense of them.
Yeah, and that is the idea we're going to be talking about today. It's the concept of scientific reductionism. Now, I want to start by clarifying the meaning of that term, because if you've heard that term used in conversation, there's a very good chance that you've heard it used in a way that's different than what we mean today.
Right. So people just responding on Facebook to, say, a news story about a scientific study or a theory and say, well, that sounds reductionist. You're just being a reductionist
right here.
Yeah.
So there's one version of the word reductive that means something sort of like oversimplified.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I say that, you know, the only reason French cooking tastes good is because they use like a full stick of butter in every dish. People, you know, some French chef might say, no, wait, there's a lot of technique. You're taking a very reductionist attitude. Mm-hmm. It's not that simple. Or another one you might hear. I think often these days, if you hear people talking about scientific reductionism, you're hearing it used not in a philosophical argument about the underpinnings of science, but more in an argument about the validity of worldviews. And it works as this kind of snarl word that means something like nihilism or the belief that there is nothing of value, beauty, or goodness in the world. That is not what we mean. That's not what the term means in philosophy of science, and that's not the way we're going to be using it today.
Yeah, I think a lot of this gets back to the concepts that we tackled in the Wicked Problems episode, and as well as the illusion of explanatory depth. And that's the idea that simple, broad solutions to complex societal problems, complex problems in general, tend to be ineffective and spawn new problems. And you could say that's because they take a reductionist approach to it. Robots are dangerous, so we ban all robots. Humans are the cause of war, so we exterminate all humans, right?
Now, I wonder if that way of using reductionism fits more into the haters definition or the definition we're going to look at today.
Well, the interesting thing, isn't it, that the haters definition is itself reductionist, right? And then maybe okay. That definition is also reductionist. Like, 'cause I'm, to a certain extent, yes, there are some things that are complicated enough, and if you boil them down, you can boil them down to sort of concrete solutions and concrete causes. Mm-hmm. And it depends on what you're studying. Like sometimes, especially with societal issues, it's not always that cut and dry. Mm-hmm. There are just too many factors, and it's difficult to test out the solution, certainly in real time.
Yeah.
Because by the time you've deployed the answer, you've created all these additional problems.
So that's the it's only butter explanation. Somebody's trying to explain deliciousness in terms of butter only, when in reality, it's much more complicated.
Yes.
Okay. So what I mean by scientific reductionism and what's usually discussed in philosophy of science is that as a method, mm-hmm. it means that any system or entity existing in reality will ultimately be best understood if broken down into its simpler constituent parts, and the workings of those parts are understood.
Okay.
We see this all the time in science, right? Mm-hmm. Science is constantly trying to reduce a complex phenomenon into its parts and find out how its parts work.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I mean, it's basically what How Stuff Works is all about, right?
Yeah.
It's about how is this actually working? What are the properties? What are the physical laws involved? Even if it's something as simple as, well, for instance, I wrote an article on how hula hoops work a while back.
Uh-huh.
And so part of that is like the culture of the history of the hula, in the history of the hula hoop, where it came from, how it gained popularity, how it's utilized in different ways. But you also get down to just the basic physics of what's going on when a hula hoop is swinging around a body in motion.
And you can reduce it to physics.
Yes.
So in that sense, I think that is a perfectly valid way of using a reductionist approach, is saying, like, what are the most basic laws and elements and explanatory systems that are in play when you see somebody hula hooping?
And I can see where there would be people who would say, who are like such hula hoop enthusiasts, that they would say, stop trying to explain the magic of hula hoops. When you explain the physics of hula hoops, you take all the fun out of it.
Oh.
That would be a crazy statement, because the fun's still there. We're just explaining how the fun works.
Right. And the controversy we're talking about today in this example, we can probably use a better example in a minute,
okay,
would not be whether it takes the fun out of it, but whether it misses something crucial. If you just describe a hula hoop in terms of the basic physics of how it goes around the body, are you missing something factually crucial and autonomously true about the phenomenon of hula hooping? Hula hooping,
something vital to its functionality.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's probably not a good example. But one other way we can look at what scientific reductionism is that it's a hypothesis on the final nature of the relationship between science and reality. And so it can be interpreted to mean that, in effect, every correct explanation of the world can be reduced to the most fundamental, lowest theory of reality. And essentially, everything is physics, if you go deep enough. Now, there are going to be a lot of reductionists who will say, now, I understand that we need sciences like psychology and chemistry mm-hmm. and political science and sociology to explain things that it would be ridiculous to think we can explain by looking at all the elementary particles.
Right.
But that in principle, we should be able to explain all those things given just our understanding of elementary particles and forces. They're just too complex for us to understand right now.
Right.
Okay, so let's try to put this into a specific concrete example. If you accept that everything in the universe is subject to the laws of physics, and I think, Robert, you and I can agree that as far as we know it is.
Yes.
Then everything in the universe ultimately could be best explained by fundamental physics or whatever we find lying underneath fundamental physics. Whatever's the ultimate theory of everything, the ultimate underlying law of the universe. And so let's look at a higher order phenomenon and try to say what it would mean to reduce it. So I came up with this horrible example.
Okay.
An apparent case of psychogenic blindness.
Okay.
So you are with your family on Thanksgiving, and so they get to pick what movie you go out and see. And you are overruled, and you go to see the new Adam Sandler movie, in which I imagine the next one's going to be Adam Sandler plays the 15th Dalai Lama and also plays the Dalai Lama's really loud, flatulent twin sister.
Oh.
25 minutes into the onset of this film, you go blind in both eyes. Now, you go to the doctor, and the doctors can find no evidence of injury or neurological dysfunction, so they classify this as a rare case of psychogenic blindness, blindness that's induced by psychological distress rooted in a state of mind.
Okay. And we've discussed this on the show before, especially in terms of certain almost supernatural occurrences, right? Where like there's a mystical experience and it leads to a bodily manifestation.
Yeah. And so in psychology, there might be some framework for explaining what happened to you. And that framework would be a theory like knowledge. It would be explanatory talking mm-hmm. about causes in the mind and perhaps solutions that take place in the mind. But of course, assuming that we had a complete understanding of the whole state of your body at the level of neuroscience, fully explaining all of your brain tissues and functions and how they were interacting, on the reductionist hypothesis, we actually shouldn't need the psychological explanation, right? That's just a convenience. If we understood everything there was to understand about the physical nature of your brain, we wouldn't need psychology. We wouldn't need the psychologist to say what's happening with your blindness. We could just look at the cells in your brain. Now, of course, if we had a perfect understanding of your brain from the perspective of cell biology, explaining what all the cells in your body are doing and how, we technically wouldn't need the neuroscience explanation. We'd just say, okay, here's the cell theory that, you know, this is what explains everything that's going on. And then you could reduce it further. You could say, well, of course, if we had a perfect understanding of every molecule in your body from the standpoint of fundamental chemistry, understanding what all the atoms and molecules are doing and how, we wouldn't need the biochemistry, or, you know, the biology or biochemistry explanation. And of course, if we had a perfect understanding of the whole state of your body from the standpoint of fundamental physics, you know, elementary particle physics, the quantum mechanical wave functions of all the particles and energy states in your body, we wouldn't need the chemistry explanation. So ultimately, the hypothesis goes like this. If we're able to explain everything in the universe in terms of fundamental physics, we would, and that would be the best explanation. It's only our lack of understanding and our lack of knowledge and computational power that forces us to conceive of explanations of things that are more complex than fundamental physics, like chemistry, like biology, like psychology, like, you know, sociology or political science. But at bottom, the best explanation for everything is, here are the particles and their, you know, energy states and vectors.
Now, it's almost impossible to think about something of this without, like this, without thinking about comparisons to, like, our modern computing experience.
Right.
You know, like thinking of hardware and then on top of hardware, the code, and I'm simplifying here, but then on top of the code, the sort of, user interface and then our interaction with that user interface. So it seems like you would have, I mean, realistically, you would have problems that occur with the root of that problem at different levels. In that depth, right? Something, you might have a problem at the hardware level. You might have a problem, at the user interface level.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had a complete enough understanding, we could address any problem from the bottom.
Exactly. So the physical reductionist would say, okay, but if you had a perfect understanding, yeah, everything there would be energy states and elementary particles. If mm-hmm. you understood what all of them were doing, you could fix any problem at any level.
Okay, yeah. So not even going down to the hardware level, but yeah. going down to the even more primal levels, going yeah. into the very basement of reality.
Yeah. And so the question today is, looking at that perspective of the world, is that true? Is that a correct understanding of what science is? Or are higher level sciences, more complex sciences like chemistry, biology, psychology, sociology, and so forth, do these sciences have unique insights that are not present at the lower levels of more simplicity, simpler realities? Are they just the best we can do to understand complex phenomena like society, minds, and organisms? Or are they intellectually autonomous? Do they have something original to offer?
So, like, the counter argument here would be that physics and carpentry, engineering can explain the way that a stage is built, but they are not going to have any impact on, say, the play that the actors on the stage are reciting.
Sure. Yeah. That's sort of an analogy that works, I guess. One of the things that I do want to make sure we're clarifying is that I don't plan on, Robert, you can violate this if you want, but I don't plan on exploring arguments against scientific reductionism that are based in a belief in supernatural causation.
No.
Because as we mentioned in another recent podcast, I'm not even sure the concept of supernatural causation is coherent. I'm not sure that it's incoherent, but then again, try to picture it. What are you picturing? Usually you're just picturing natural causation with some kind of blurriness or some kind of detail obscured.
Right. It's like the hand of God analogy. If God is something outside of our universe, then for that hand to reach into our universe to do something, it has to adhere to the laws of physics. It has to wear the glove of our reality, at least, and then has to therefore be observable as a physical phenomenon.
Yeah. To do something, it has to do something.
Right.
but we will instead look at a different concept that is the concept of emergentism, a philosophical distinction that says that there are large complex systems that show genuinely novel properties due to their complexity that are not inherently predictable from or reducible to the combined effects of their simpler, more constituent parts, and ultimately not predictable from or reducible to fundamental physics.
Okay.
So let's.
And this is where I come back to my perhaps imperfect analogy of the stage and the actors on the stage.
Okay.
You can't have one without the other, but one seems to be operating in a way that the lower level cannot fully predict or control beyond very basic levels.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. I think that's a good analogy then. I'm sorry if I was skeptical at the beginning.
No. A healthy dose of skepticism is important here.
Okay, so given our idea that we're going to look at emergentism as a form of material understanding of the world, you know, it's an extension of science, not an expression of like vitalism or supernaturalism. What are some examples of things in nature that we might assume are not able to be explained by fundamental physics?
Well, a big one is intelligence.
Like, oh, yeah.
Even playing like Dungeons and Dragons, where you have a definite intelligence score versus like wisdom or charisma.
Yeah.
I often find myself in conversations with the people I'm playing with, like, well, would this be an intelligence check or a wisdom check? Like, we really have a very ambiguous idea of what constitutes intelligence.
Yeah. But at the same time, intelligence is, I think, by the fact that you consider it this separate property, that you have this separate score in, it's natural to think of it as something that discreetly emerges at higher levels of complexity and isn't reducible to simpler objects. So, like you said, it's sometimes kind of difficult to define intelligence. What is it? My favorite definition that I've come across is that intelligence is the tendency of a system to accelerate the solution of problems.
Okay.
It leads to faster solving. So, however we define it, we know it when we see it, right? Intelligence is highly useful, ubiquitous, undeniable. It's part of our experience of the everyday world. But can intelligence be explained in terms of simpler fundamental units? I don't know. After all, there is no indication that a single neuron possesses anything like intelligence. There's no analogy for intelligence below what things like brains or computers do, at least as far as I can tell.
Well, and even then, it's far more complicated. I mean, I feel like we've probably even covered it on the show before, the whole topic of what makes a genius. What does a genius's brain look like?
Yeah.
And yes, you can draw certain, you can look to the gray matter and line up various factors, but a lot of it is going to be beyond that. It's going to have to do with, with the experience and personality of the individual.
Yeah.
It's the whole Boys from Brazil scenario. We're trying to clone Hitler.
Yeah. So, I mean, assuming that animal intelligence or computer intelligence is not magic, I mean, we're not believing it's magic, but that it's still possible that it can't be explained reductively by recourse to more fundamental sciences, that chemistry alone can't explain intelligence. It's something that only happens to matter at a certain level of complexity and configuration, and is not predictable from lower levels of understanding. So what would it mean to understand intelligence at the level of single cells? I don't know. Maybe it's possible to do that, but it at least sounds like a very difficult project.
Yeah, I mean, so the basic idea here is that interactions among smaller entities lead to larger entities, and that there's a self-organizing aspect to reality.
Uh-huh.
It's what economist Jeffrey Goldstein called, quote, the arising of novel and coherent structures, patterns, and properties during the process of self-organization in complex systems.
Right.
So I think like a classic sort of science example I always go back to is just the accretion of cosmic dust into smaller bodies and clouds, building mass, exerting gravity, forming stars, planet, everything else, gravitating around each other, held in gravitational enslavement to each other, and becoming the system, a system that emerges initially from just particles floating around and bumping into each other.
Right. And thus, it does obey the laws of physics at every level, but is it reducible to and predictable from those laws?
When the case of just like basic, the basic assembly of a solar system of a galaxy, I would think yes. I think this is definitely a physics-based, bringing together of properties. But it's such a, maybe it's because it's just such a grandiose thing to imagine assembling from such minute pieces. It feels an appropriate metaphor for the emergence of, say, consciousness, the emergence of intelligence, because if dust can turn into the Milky Way galaxy, and I'm simplifying, but if something so vast and complex and energetic can come together from such small pieces, then it makes sense that something as, at least for the, on the individual level, as complex and amazing and brilliant as intelligence and consciousness, that too could emerge from just things bumping into each other.
Well, yeah, and there you do say something that I think should put us on guard against the concept of emergentism, which is that it feels good to us. You know, the idea that no, you know, things like intelligence and higher order concepts really are somehow unique at their level of organization, and they're not just reducible to elementary particles and energy states. That's something we like to feel.
Right.
And so thus, I think we should be a little on guard about that idea.
Yeah, but I would, to counter, I would say that basically the idea, if consciousness, if being conscious, if being alive feels majestic, I think we can look to just the universe itself and say, well, if the universe in all its majesty is based on things bumping into each other, you know, randomly, and an order arising out of all of that, then it's no great stretch to say that the mind is the same.
The cosmos is a humiliating analogy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you can go either way. You can say, my mind is like the universe, man. But you can also say, hey, your mind is just like the universe. It's just stuff bumping into each other until a system emerges.
Okay. Well, maybe we should look at a few more examples of supposed emergent behavior that you can see in nature. Systems where, you know, at a complex enough level, things seem to happen that are not obviously predictable from the simpler components acting alone.
Well, evolution is a big one, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Just I mean, that's the basic underlying principle, right? In this constant race, the survival of the fittest, the natural selection, that, you have all these different forms, these various mutations that are, you know, kind of throwing out different versions of the same product into the open market of brutal survivalism. And then whatever sticks, sticks.
Yeah. And so that's a thing. Like, if you were just in a universe where there was no life, but there was just, say, organic chemistry, would you be able to really predict that evolution was going to occur? Maybe. I don't know. What about, here's a product of evolution that's often been cited as a really interesting version of emergent behavior, hive insect behavior.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this is always a cool concept. The view of eusocial insects, bees, wasps, ants, termites, etc. But especially bees and ants being like the prime examples of this.
Yeah.
They're essentially an emergent system. After all, you know, how else is all this behavior going to get there?
Right.
Like, nobody's programming the ants. Nobody's telling them, oh, you're the queen and you mm-hmm. do this.
No one ant or one bee is able to display anything like the hive behavior we see.
Yeah.
And not even any small group of them show these rudimentary signs of it. It's only when you get enough of them interacting that hive behavior emerges.
Yeah. And out of all of these little interactions, these roles, it all adds up to a kind of, it's important to say, you know, non-sci-fi, in the non-science fictional sense, a hive mind. You know,
they don't like share a conscious experience.
Right. They're not, you know, they don't have their brains all hooked up with tubes into a, you know, floating mega brain or something. But in a very real non-sci-fi sense, there is this hive mind, this hive think that emerges, and they're able to do many things as a group, solve problems as a group that the individual is just not. I mean, it's almost cheating to say they're incapable of it, because they are capable of it as this sort of meta-organism that they become, just not on the individual level.
Yeah.
And this approach has proven very useful in artificial intelligence and robotics. I'm sure you've covered this in the past in the Forward Thinking podcast.
Yeah.
The study of eusocial insects and figuring out how to, as robotics and engineers, face challenges in the interactions of simple machines, machine learning. So you essentially have the creation of like little robots that are behaving like ants.
Yeah. Here's another big one. Consciousness. This is probably the thing that is most often discussed as a potentially irreducible phenomenon in nature. So you have a mind. You don't just have a brain, but you have a mind. Assuming you do have a mind. It's impossible for me to know anybody else in the world has a mind. I assume you do. You seem like you do. And you claim to, usually. But yeah, you've got a mind, a conscious experience, and there's no analogy that we can find or that we have good evidence of at lower levels. Right. There's no evidence that single neurons are conscious. There's no evidence that atoms or molecules or anything like that have any kind of rudimentary consciousness. Some people assume this. There's like a philosophical position known as panpsychism, which is the idea that in some kind of way, consciousness exists all over the universe in all matter.
This is the idea that any sufficiently complex system may manifest as consciousness.
No. This is the idea that all matter is in some sense, that a rock is in some sense conscious.
Right. By virtue of being like a complex system.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I mean, because even a rock is complex when you start breaking it down and you start really diving deep Powers of Ten style into it.
Now, I think that's an interesting speculation, but I don't see any evidence for that. It would be hard to know what evidence for that would be.
Yeah, yeah, I like it too. I think it lines up nicely with some various supernatural interpretations of reality.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure how much I'm willing to invest in it at this point.
So we
until the rock speaks,
right? When will it speak? And what would it say?
That's the thing. I mean, a rock's a rock. It's seen a lot of stuff, but it hasn't really been up to much.
You got mud on your face. Big disgrace. So, oh, never mind.
Oh, yes, we will rock you. Yeah, good reference.
You can shame me later. Okay. One more thing I would think of is the human equivalent of hive insect behavior. What about social sciences, sociology, political science, anthropology, the study of what humans do in large groups? There seem to be phenomena there that are not strictly predictable from just understanding of, say, psychology. Could you look at a really, really good understanding of psychology and say, this is how societies will work? I don't know.
I mean, there are those who extrapolate meaning from psychological concepts or those who attempt to, but yeah, it becomes increasingly complicated.
Talking about this difference between, reducible phenomena and emergent phenomena, one of my favorite often misattributed quotes, Joseph Stalin is alleged to have said, falsely alleged to have said, quantity has a quality all its own. I've always liked that quote. I can't find any evidence he ever said this, but mm-hmm. it does sort of echo a sentiment explored by Marx and Engels in their writings about economics and their adaptation of Hegelian dialectical philosophy. That quantitative differences over time, which is what we'd sort of be looking at for reductive philosophy of science, mm-hmm. just quantitative changes actually do become qualitative differences. More is not just more. In many cases, more is different.
Yes, and I think this plays in nicely with a couple of papers we'll look at later in the episode. Mm-hmm. As long as we're throwing out quotes, one I always have enjoyed on this sort of topic of emergence is one from the poet Wallace Stevens, his poem, Connoisseur of Chaos. A violent order is a disorder, and B, a great disorder is an order. These two things are one. Pages of illustrations.
Oh man, that's a good one. Yeah. Stevens has a lot of great quotes that I think somehow apply to science.
Yeah.
You know, when I often, I get these feelings about what must be true in science, but then I often hear in the back of my mind that line from The Emperor of Ice Cream.
Oh yes.
Let be finale of seem.
He's a good one. If anyone out there is looking to pick up some thought-provoking poetry, get yourself a book of Wallace Stevens and flip around in there.
Okay, well, I think we should take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will look at one of our main resources in this episode, a classic paper from the history of science from the 1970s called More is Different.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, we're back. So tell me, Joe, is more different?
That's a good question, Robert. That's sort of the central question of this episode. As you reach higher levels of complexity, you get more things together interacting. Do different, uniquely new properties emerge, or is it just more and more? Well, in 1972, the Nobel Prize-winning American physicist Philip W. Anderson published this massively influential, highly cited paper in the journal Science. And the title of the essay was "More is Different," and as you can probably guess based on the title, what position he took on the emergentist debate. Mm-hmm. So Anderson writes that while at the time he was writing, which was 1972, philosophers might still debate scientific reductionism, but he said scientists don't. Scientists just take scientific reductionism for granted. And his formulation of the reductionist hypothesis went like this, quote, "The workings of our minds and bodies and of all the animate or inanimate matter of which they have any detailed knowledge are assumed to be controlled by the same set of fundamental laws, which except under certain extreme conditions we feel we know pretty well." In other words, he's saying when you chase causal explanations deep enough, it all boils down to the bottom. It all goes straight down to fundamental physics.
And that is as it should be, right? Yeah. I mean, that's why we established all of these basic fundamental physical laws and interactions, because we wanted an idea of how the universe works.
Yeah.
And so everything should boil down to those laws.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, that would indicate there's some sort of problem with our laws and our physics.
Exactly. Yeah. What good is physics if it's not actually fundamental?
Right.
So Anderson says, you know, if this is true, many people assume that it entails the idea that very few people in the sciences are actually working on anything fundamental, anything autonomous, anything original. And to illustrate this example or this frame of mind, Anderson quotes this passage from the theoretical physicist Victor F. Weisskopf, which sorts all science into these two categories, which Weisskopf calls intensive and extensive. So intensive research tries to discover fundamental laws. Extensive research tries to explain phenomena with the use of known fundamental laws. So at any given time, a minority, a very small minority of scientists, generally in fields like particle physics, are working on describing fundamental laws that govern reality. They're doing the intensive science. And meanwhile, the vast majority of scientists are just taking the models of fundamental laws and applying them as an explanation for anything, for why the rain in Nashville smells like hot dog water.
Does it?
Or sometimes. Oh. Sometimes. I'm just kidding. You know, sometimes rain anywhere smells like hot dog water.
I haven't spent enough time in Nashville to know.
You know, anything. Why your eyes won't stop bleeding. So the extension of this distinction, some presume, is that once we have a fundamental theory of physics at the base of all science, there's no intensive science left to do. Does that make sense? Like, you could still apply theories up the chain, but there's nothing original left to discover. It's just continually the application of what we know to different phenomena. But Anderson throws down a flag here. He says, hold on. Let's say we accept the reductionist hypothesis that we can reduce complex phenomena and explanations to simpler, more fundamental physical laws. That doesn't necessarily imply the converse, which he calls the, quote, constructionist hypothesis. It does not, in his words, it does not imply the ability to start from those laws and reconstruct the universe.
Hmm.
So what is science supposed to do? It's supposed to be able to predict, right? If you have a correct scientific theory, you should be able to make accurate predictions about the future.
Right.
But if you can't make accurate predictions about the future from the fundamental laws of physics, then do the fundamental laws of physics really describe everything? So in Anderson's view, why does it not imply that we can start from the fundamental laws and predict everything? You know, shouldn't we be able to do that in principle? Well, according to Anderson, the answer is no. And Anderson says there are two main problems with the constructionist hypothesis. One is scale and the other is complexity. And I just want to read a quote from him. Anderson writes, quote, "The behavior of large and complex aggregations of elementary particles," so that would be anything,
right?
A football, to return to a hot dog, mm-hmm. a jar of pickles.
A Twinkie.
Yes. I guess I'm all thinking of cylindrical foods. I'm not sure why. The behavior of large and complex aggregations of elementary particles, it turns out, is not to be understood in terms of a simple explanation of the properties of a few particles. Instead, at each level of complexity, entirely new properties appear, and the understanding of the new behaviors requires research, which I think is as fundamental in its nature as any other. So he's throwing in with a certain version of the emergentist hypothesis. Studying what happens to more complex bodies, like studying what happens to a jar of pickles, is doing original research. That is actually yielding hypotheses and theories that are not predictable from just understanding the particles that make up that jar of pickles.
Well, this just reminds me again of societal examples and the idea of wicked problems, that, like, yeah, rolling out a solution into a complex system that is society and not realizing that the solution is going to spin off additional problems. It's going to create additional complexity. There are going to be emergent problems out of your solution.
Right. There are things we can't predict from simpler principles, even if those simpler principles are correct.
Yeah.
So just to clarify, Anderson accepts that the sciences of more complex phenomena are explanatorily dependent on the sciences of simpler phenomena, right? Psychology is, in a sense, dependent on biology. We couldn't have it without it, you know, which is dependent on chemistry, which is dependent on physics. But explicitly, he rejects the idea that this means psychology is just applied biology, or that biology is just applied chemistry. At each of these new levels of complexity, genuinely novel properties emerge, which are not necessarily predictable from a complete understanding of the more fundamental science. And he grounds this in an example from his own field, because he works in many-body physics. And he grounds it in this concept that is known as symmetry breaking. So what does that mean? Well, for Anderson, the study of fundamental physics is almost synonymous with the study of symmetry. In other words, fundamental physics is the search for the laws of reality that are homogeneous and isotropic. Now, what does that mean? It means they're the same everywhere and they apply to everything, no matter from what vantage point you look. That sounds like a good description to me of what the fundamental laws should be. In other words, they're fundamentally symmetrical. They're the same everywhere.
Right. It works in the city, works in the country, works on Earth, works in Alpha Centauri.
Right. And that's what physics should be. But while all matter obeys basic electrodynamics and quantum theory, many objects in the universe, and not just minds and societies, but Anderson uses examples of tiny basic physical structures, many of these objects display novel or asymmetrical properties, which he says are not strictly predictable from the symmetrical laws that govern them. So these asymmetries include, he gives examples like the inversion of the ammonia molecule, the shapes of atomic nuclei, like sometimes an atomic nucleus you can work out mathematically is in a sense shaped like a football or shaped like a plate. And he talks about the structures of crystals. These are, you know, they should be, they're based on symmetrical laws, but the symmetrical laws end up generating asymmetries in reality. So in Anderson's view, the question is, why are large systems not just bigger than elementary particles, but fundamentally different from them with unique properties to study? And here I want to read a quote from Anderson. He says, quote, "The essential idea is that in the so-called into infinity, in approaching infinity, limit of large systems," which means stuff on our own macroscopic scale, "it is not only convenient, but essential to realize that matter will undergo mathematically sharp, singular phase transitions to state at which the microscopic symmetries and even the microscopic equations of motion are in a sense violated. The symmetry leaves behind as its expression only certain characteristic behaviors, for example, long wavelength vibrations, of which the familiar example is sound waves, or the unusual macroscopic conduction phenomena of the superconductor, or, in a very deep analogy, the very rigidity of crystal lattices, and thus of most solid matter. There is, of course, no question of the systems really violating, as opposed to breaking, the symmetry of space and time. But because its parts find it energetically more favorable to maintain certain fixed relationships with each other, the symmetry allows only the body as a whole to respond to external forces. So again, he's not saying that a big system, macroscopic system like a jar of pickles, violates the laws of physics, but he's saying at certain levels of complexity, large objects make more sense understood as a whole than at the level of their constituent parts. And the whole has a novel scheme of behavior that's not easily predictable from the nature of its elementary particles. And then, of course, there he's like, well, now we've just talked about, you know, crystals and stuff like that. But he, of course, says, you know, this applies to DNA and stuff like that, too. Of course, mm-hmm. once you get much more complex, the problem is magnified all the more. Things just become really seemingly impossible to reduce to or predict from the underlying laws of elementary particles. There are these quantum leaps where it appears that quantity has a quality all its own suddenly. And of course, in the end of his paper, he paraphrases Marx in that saying, quantity has a quality all its own. And then I love this. He also quotes a supposed conversation between F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, where of course Fitzgerald says, the rich are different from us. And Hemingway replies, yes, they have more money.
Now, this is interesting because it immediately brings to mind some like reductionist criticisms that are thrown out I've seen before about, say, the human beings, to say, oh, well, you can dissect a human being. You can hold a human heart in your hand, mm-hmm. but you're not going to get a sense of who that person was based on that experience.
Yeah. And I would say actually that, that Anderson is not the final word on this, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, people disagree with him.
Right.
But this has been a really interesting and influential paper. And it's also not to rule out the idea that redundant sciences do exist somewhere. For example, there might be fields of science that really do reduce to nothing more than the application of principles of a more fundamental field of science. But it just looks like this is not the case for most, if not all, mature scientific fields. But somebody out there in a lab right now, it could happen to you. You could be reduced to a simpler study, field of study. Okay, but maybe we should look at a counterpoint, because as I mentioned, not everybody agrees with Anderson. So what if maybe it's not as different as you think? More might seem different or feel different. More might be useful to treat as different given our limitations, but maybe it's not really different. There's nothing actually unique going on at higher levels of complexity. It's just convenient for us to treat it that way.
Okay.
And here I want to come to another Nobel Prize winning American physicist, Steven Weinberg, who offers a really interesting complementary counter analysis in his 1993 book, Dreams of a Final Theory. Have you ever read anything by Weinberg?
I am not sure that I have.
He's a really good writer. Mm-hmm. The first chapter of this book is just this brilliant, rollicking, fun adventure through science, through chemistry and particle physics, if you can believe that, where he talks about a piece of chalk. Mm-hmm. And he's like, let's apply the reductionist hypothesis to a piece of chalk and in every way possible, look at its properties and ask why. And every time you ask why is the chalk white? Why is the chalk shaped like it is? Why, you know, any question like that, what you're doing essentially is playing the reductionist game, right?
Oh,
you're going one level down.
I have to do that all the time as a father.
Yeah.
I'm constantly asked questions. I mean, he hasn't asked me about chalk, but I can easily imagine him asking me those very questions. Why is it white? Why does it do this? Why does it that? We get very reductionist questions about virtually everything.
And when you do that, you're putting reductionism into practice.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying, okay, well, I can explain these higher properties in terms of lower properties,
yeah.
simpler properties that cause an effect we see at a large scale.
Yeah. I often don't see it quite that beautifully. Generally, it's like, oh, geez, I'm just trying to drive you to school, and now I've got to explain gravity, you know, because you were asking about a bird or a football or something.
What, like, why did that bird fly into the car window? Is it that sad?
No.
Okay.
Fortunately not. But, you know, it'll just be, you know, random, wonderful questions about just how the universe works. And it'll generally start with a particular detail, but it quickly spirals out into these very complex, notions of reality.
Yeah. So Weinberg is a fan of reductionism. Weinberg, he's looking for a final theory. He mm-hmm. wants a final theory of physics. And ultimately he says, yeah, maybe not in practice can we actually reduce everything to physics. Like, it might just be beyond our capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
But in theory, everything should be reducible to fundamental physics. There should be no higher order insights, really. It's all there in the physics. So in this opening chapter, he's discussing problems with putting the reductionist hypothesis into practice. And he acknowledges there are plenty of problems. He's not cavalier about that. And one of the problems with reducing things like biology to fundamental physics is that he points out biology is not just a product of fundamental laws, but also biology incorporates stuff that happened in the past. Like, it is the product of both the fundamental laws of physics and some accidents of history,
right.
in Weinberg's view. Biology wouldn't be the way it was if some different things had happened in the past. So I think that's kind of interesting. And in this sense, you see in sciences like biology, the past becomes calcified into structures that all life on Earth uses. And so physics appears to be timeless and universal, but biology is a contingent science. It's a result of something that happened at one point. You could maybe go to a higher level and say that even physics could be that way. Maybe there's a multiverse. Maybe the laws of physics in this local universe are in fact contingent. They didn't have to be that way. Different universes could have different laws of physics. That's possible, but they at least appear to be universal in this universe.
Okay. So when we look at a complex system, we're also looking at a process.
Yeah.
Okay.
Weinberg also deals with the concept of emergence, and he's respectful toward it, but he tries to show that he thinks it doesn't undercut the reductionist hypothesis. So he cites Anderson's essay, More is Different, and Weinberg stresses, like Anderson, that while most obvious examples of potential emergence are in the biological and social sciences, if emergence exists, it appears to be in physics as well. And he gives this prime example, thermodynamics. The study of heat. Now, you might be thinking like, well, how could heat be all that complex? Heat is mega complex. If you ask somebody who's been trying to do, you know, calculations in thermodynamics, it's really complicated. And Weinberg points out that in the 19th century, thermodynamics was a fundamentally different and distinct science. It was considered logically autonomous and kept separate from general mechanics. So you might have your Newtonians over here, doing their mechanics work, and then you've got your thermodynamicists.
Huh.
And so while physics relied on concepts like particles and forces, he says thermodynamics relied on concepts like temperature and entropy, which just did not have counterparts in general mechanics. He says that the only real bridge was the first law of thermodynamics, which was the conservation of energy that linked thermodynamics with the rest of physics. But he writes that the main idea in thermodynamics was the second law, which says that in any closed system, there's this magical quantity called entropy, which tends to increase over time until the system reaches a state of equilibrium, until everything just sort of equals out and becomes very mellow.
Mm-hmm.
But then he writes, in the 19th century, physicists took the second law of thermodynamics as an axiom. They believed in it basically on the basis of induction. And you could and still can see examples of thermodynamics all over nature. You can look at the behavior of steam billowing up from a pot and see thermodynamics. You could see freezing and boiling liquids. And then you can even see versions of what look like thermodynamics in globular clusters in space. But if you see thermodynamics principles play out all over all scales of the universe, from like molecules of H2O in your kitchen to clouds and clouds of stars and galaxies, then surely thermodynamics is logically independent from fundamental physics, right? But Weinberg says no. He writes that eventually the work of theoretical physicists like Maxwell, Boltzmann, and Gibbs showed that, quote, the principles of thermodynamics could in fact be deduced mathematically by an analysis of the probabilities of different configurations of certain kinds of system, those systems whose energy is shared among a very large number of subsystems, as, for instance, a gas whose energy is shared among the molecules of which it is composed. So, in other words, they came up with the interpretive bridge to show how thermodynamics reduces to underlying mechanics, statistical mechanics. And this amazing, weird property known as heat really just is the combined kinetic energy of all the particles in a system. And that's what we're taught in school now. You learn heat is the kinetic energy of vibrating particles. And entropy, it's just actually a measure of how disordered the system is. Entropy, it just means the amount of order in a closed system decreases over time. So thermodynamics, he says, has been reduced to underlying theories of particles and forces. And yet, Weinberg writes, you know, these higher order, complex, and seemingly emergent properties like temperature and entropy, which have no counterpart at the scale of individual particles, they're just not there down low, are still useful for lots of kinds of explanations. So he's not saying higher order sciences aren't useful. They're just not actually fundamental. They're not describing anything novel necessarily. So he concludes this discussion that by saying, quote, thermodynamics is more like a mode of reasoning than a body of universal physical law. Wherever it applies, it always allows us to justify the use of the same principles, but the explanation of why thermodynamics does apply to any particular system takes the form of a deduction using the methods of statistical mechanics from the details of what the system contains, and this inevitably leads us down to the level of elementary particles. So he's saying it's useful, but it's elementary physics there. What's driving it is really fundamental physics. So my interpretation of Weinberg here is that he's using the example of thermodynamics to show that while these higher order sciences dealing with complex phenomena might always remain explanatory useful, they're just never logically autonomous, never fundamental, never independent. And they might be good to retain for purposes of communication and understanding, but they don't describe fundamental truths. For that, you need reduction to fundamental physics paired with an acknowledgement of accidents of history and ultimately a theory of everything.
Okay. So basically, any of these different fields is ultimately going to be a subset of another field.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss this in terms of some more human elements.
Right.
So if your mind is exploding with all of the thermodynamics, bear with us because things are going to get a little more human.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Okay, so we just looked at some difficult examples of where emergent properties may appear to exist in things like crystals or thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. They might really exist and be fundamental. They might just be an illusion that they're not actually fundamental. But one of the places where people have a really hard time not seeing something unique and original at higher levels of complexity is in the human sciences,
yeah,
in things like psychology and anthropology. So maybe we should look at a couple of examples of papers taking the idea of emergentism and applying it to these higher complexity sciences.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of this boils down to like, what's the saying? Three's company, four's a crowd. Like there, I mean, in our own experience, we know that as more people gather together, certain realities come online, certain social responsibilities come online. Like, for instance, yoga classes. If anyone out there has ever been in a yoga class or an exercise class, if there are just two people in it, if there's just a teacher and a student, one of the realities, not to be crude, is that there is no plausible deniability of flatulence. If one person passes gas and it's audible, or not audible, if it's noticeable, then there's no questioning who did it.
Right.
But if there are three, then there's plausible deniability.
Then you've got a society, you've got suspicion, and you've got bluffing.
Exactly. And I mean, that's just a very simple example, but this takes place the more you expand the social dynamic. And there have been studies that have looked into this, in you know, broader, less crude terms, of course. One paper in particular, and this is one that you found for us here, is from Robert L. Carnario, The Transition from Quantity to Quality, a Neglected Causal Mechanism in Accounting for Social Evolution.
I was interested in this one because it plays on the idea of quantity becoming quality.
So yeah, the basic nugget here is that when the quantitative increase in some entity reaches a certain threshold, the situation gives rise to a qualitative change. So
more is different.
Right, exactly. It's that same process, but the idea is that it would break down, beyond mere biological and chemical examples. We've touched on some of them already, but like a couple more that the author brings up here, like the critical mass of uranium or the quantitative difference in the wavelength of the light received by our retina and the effect that has on color perception.
Huh.
So I guess you can think of in terms, there's a tipping point, where
where quantity becomes quality.
Oh, yeah. I never thought about that. Wavelengths of light.
Mm-hmm.
So increasing wavelengths, suddenly we just perceive a different color.
Right. That's the basic idea. But the author here focuses on the notion that quantitative increases in the form of population give rise to a change in the structure of a society. So it's that yoga example. It's the threes company, fours a crowd, except he explores it through some various other examples here. So on a basic level, let's say we have a village of humans.
Okay.
And it reaches a large enough size that what you end up having factions emerge, clans emerge. Like this is a classic trope of various fictional scenarios in which you have outsiders and survivalists. You know, Stephen King's The Mist, Lord of the Flies, Lost. You're going to have factions emerge, right? And this is reality television.
Wait, did you mean The Mist or The Stand?
Oh, well, both, right?
I guess. Oh, okay.
Because The Mist is like simplified version of that. Right. They're all trapped in the supermarket.
Uh-huh.
And then immediately there are two different factions. There's like it's been a while since I've read it, but I remember there's one faction is a little more,
apocalyptic
than the other. Yeah. So who's to say which one is correct given that, apocalyptic scenario? But, we see splintering in groups. We see splintering in countries and organizations, both real and fictional. I mean, who can forget the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front, right?
Right. From the Life of Brian.
Yeah. Well, you have the two different resistance organizations that have splintered from the one, and then additional satellite organizations have splintered off as well.
I think also there, I guess, satirizing the narcissism of small differences.
Yes. Now, when it breaks down to their actual villages, the Kayapo villages typically hit 600 or 800 persons. Okay. That's like their upper limit.
Mm-hmm.
The Yanomamo, however, they tend to max out at 200 or even a little below, and then they splinter. So the difference here is that the Kayapo boast a complex social segmentation consisting of clans, while the Yanomamo have only a few different lineages. So the takeaway here is that larger population aggregates can bring about an abrupt elaboration in social structure. So it's interesting because the larger group, the group that's able to maintain the larger village, does so through this complexity. Like it's almost like if you were to apply it to an engineering mm-hmm. standpoint, like to create a large domed building, is going to be more of an engineering feat and require a little more finesse than, like a small, like a igloo type hut.
Oh, it's kind of like how we've talked about, the difference between building a house and building a skyscraper.
Right.
Skyscraper is not just bigger. It's
right.
a different thing. It's
yeah.
a different project.
You can't just have
approach it with a different mentality.
Exactly. You can't just have a larger elephant. You yeah. have to have a different organism
uh-huh.
that may resemble in some way the elephant. And so we see that reflected here. He also points out North American Plains Indians. They displayed a tendency to rely on simple social organizations for small bands. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So they're existing in small groups, and they'll have a leader of those groups, but the leader doesn't exert a tremendous amount of power. But then when they'll periodically come together for, say, some sort of a large hunt or tribal exercise, and then they'll organize under a tribal chief who exerts far greater power than a regional. So it's not like even a necessarily a proportional change in power. It's a
right.
significant change in power. Like the complexity really takes off. And then when they have to splinter again, it all just kind of goes away. But it seems very emergent in its form.
Right.
In that it's not like, oh, there are more of us now. This is the way we do things. It's more like this is the way we do things when we come together
huh.
by necessity. We're making the bigger elephant here.
Interesting.
And he points to some other sources on this. There's a quote here included from anthropologist Michael J. Harner, who observed that, quote, population pressure is a major determinant of social evolution, and that we see this in all of humanity's greatest transformation. So agriculture, industry, science, etc., greater land subsistence resource scarcity with consequently intensified competition for its control. This leads to the spread of war, the development of states, and all the human complexity that spreads out from that.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how, in a sense, large society is, I guess they're emphasizing here, just not predictable from small groups of humans.
Mm-hmm.
that it transforms into this fundamentally different thing with different functions. And yeah, I mean, I can definitely see this even at a small scale, like you were talking about with the yoga class.
Uh-huh.
This is getting very colloquial with the idea of emergentism, but you know, a gathering of five friends is not just larger than a gathering of two friends. It's very, very different.
Yeah. And to come back to the apocalyptic examples from fiction we were drawing, I think that's one of the appeals of stuff like The Walking Dead or The Stand or The Mist, in that these examples reduce the human population to a much smaller and at least seemingly manageable number.
Yeah.
And then we try to, in a sense, we're trying to reduce societal problems to fundamental properties. Like, everything goes screwy because of this character.
Yeah.
Look how he or she is behaving.
You can be familiar with all of the agents that matter.
Right.
And this is not true of society today.
Mm-hmm.
There are tons of agents acting upon your life who you don't even know who they are or what their names are.
Yeah, or it's not necessarily, oh, the villainous character. It's more like, oh, it's the villainous aura that emerges when this group of people get together with these ideals in mind. And these ideals are actually really positive, but then there's this negative manifestation of it. Yeah, complexity emerges fairly quickly.
Hmm.
And then there was another study looked at here, and this is R. Keith Sawyer, Emergence in Psychology, Lessons from the History of Non-Reductionist Science. And the basic nugget in this one was that while we often look to psychology for a reductionist view, there's a lot of potential in an emergent view of psychology. The mind is not merely a shadow cast by a functioning brain, which is kind of an analogy I often fall back on, but a higher level emergent system forming the shadow puppet on the wall and continually revising its form.
So like, even if you don't take a substance dualist point of view, even if you don't think that the mind is supernatural in some sense, you could still find some merit in the idea that the mind is not fully explicable from the standpoint of neuroscience.
Yes, that's my takeaway from the paper anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't just look at all the tissue in the brain and say this is the kind of mind it would generate.
Correct.
Okay, well, one more thing I wanted to look at before we wrap things up is we've heard from the reductionist view of Weinberg, and then we've heard from emergentists like Anderson, but Anderson accepts one interpretation of reductionism. He just rejects another interpretation of it. What about people who are way far out there in fully rejecting explanatory reductionism in all its forms? Obviously, the debate is still going on among some thinkers, and I found a good short essay from 2014 by the biologist and philosopher of science Massimo Piliucci about this ongoing debate, and he discusses the work of a few philosophers like John Dupre, Jerry Fodor, and Nancy Cartwright, who have argued against the fundamental unity of sciences and against the reductionist hypothesis. And I think he makes a few interesting points. One, he talks about Jerry Fodor making a distinction about what it means for one science to reduce to another anyway. So you could be talking about ontological reduction, which just means that the more complex phenomena, the mind is literally made out of the simpler phenomena. You know, the mind literally is dependent upon the brain. You can agree with that.
Right.
But this part might be pretty obviously true to you. Molecules are made out of atoms. Organisms are made out of cells. Populations are made out of individual organisms. But when it comes to theoretical reduction, which you might also call explanatory reduction, the same does not necessarily hold true. While complex phenomena are made out of simpler phenomena, our theories explaining complex phenomena are different than the things themselves. They exist in our minds, not in physical space. And just because the thing reduces does not necessarily mean that the proper explanation for it reduces. I know that's kind of a strange philosophical point, but I think there might be a grain of truth there. Another thing, though, is that reductionism is not supported by an inductive survey of the progress of science. This is kind of interesting, and I think I mostly agree with him on this one. Instead of more complex theories collapsing into simpler ones, what have we seen in the history of science? We've seen exactly the opposite. Instead, we see the proliferation of more and more specialized theories.
Right.
We don't see the specific science collapsing into the general. We see the general branching off into the specific. Now, maybe this just means our study of science isn't mature enough yet, you know, like that we haven't done enough work reducing complex sciences into simpler ones. That's possible, but if you're just to look at it inductively, the science is not reducing. That's not happening at all. And one more thing is that Fodor says, you know, the reductionist assumption is not, as far as we know, actually guided by a principle. It might be intuitive, especially to scientists who have, you know, some other phenomena, who have seen some other phenomena successfully reduced to simpler principles. Think of Weinberg talking about thermodynamics. But what reason do we actually have to assume that biology can be fully explained by physics? I don't know. My intuition certainly tells me it can be, but my intuition, of course, is not worth a sack of split peas in science. And then one last idea I wanted to end on, because I thought this was really weird, but also very interesting, is the anti-realism of Nancy Cartwright, the philosopher of science, Nancy Cartwright, not the voice actress who plays Bart Simpson. So she offers a positive rationale for believing that theories for complex phenomena might not be expected to reduce to theories for simpler ones. And she advocates what's known as an anti-realist position. And in her case, what this means is she rejects the idea that there is such a thing as fundamental laws of nature. Now, you might be thinking, how on earth could you do that? Well, this it sounds kind of weird, but go with her for a second.
Okay.
I think it's actually kind of interesting. One thing we can't deny is that science works, right? We know it works practically, pragmatically. It just works. It generates theories that make predictions which are accurate enough for us to make technology and make civilization out of them. But what if they're not, in fact, truly universal and fundamental, but rather, as I said a minute ago, accurate enough? And there's really a precedent for this in the history of the pursuit of physics already, because for a long time, what did we have in physics? We had the mechanics of Isaac Newton, and they were accurate enough that we could use them to predict the motions of baseballs, or if I throw a jar of pickles at your face, even try to study the motions of planets. This could pretty much all be explained accurately by Newtonian mechanics. And we could make technology out of them. We could fire cannonballs, all that stuff. But we now know that, strictly speaking, Newton was wrong. His laws were not able to generate very accurate predictions at things beyond the medium scales of matter and energy. And for those things, they've now been replaced with things like general relativity and quantum mechanics, which can give us even more accurate predictions to explain those weird few cases where Newtonian mechanics break down in our experience. So where does Nancy Cartwright go with this? She says, well, what if, in fact, all possible fundamental theories are like that? Accurate enough to make predictions, but not actually descriptive of inviolable universal laws. So this could maybe explain why, or at least the ultimate reason why, it proves so hard to reduce all science to physics.
Because we haven't essentially an imperfect system that merely lines up with most things.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, the idea would be, yeah, that physics will always be imperfect, that there is no universal physics at bottom. There's only predictive enough. And in Cartwright's terminology, this would mean that all scientific laws are, quote, phenomenological, good enough to reckon our experience of the world at the level of their appropriate application, but not necessarily truly universal and fundamental.
Okay.
And if that's the case, that could essentially apply all down the line, you know, because there is this inherent indeterminacy or, you know, this inherent imprecision at the basis of all matter and energy. You can understand why higher, more complex levels of science would not be reducible to lower ones.
So it's like saying there's no United States. There's actually just all these different states. There's no there's no European Union. There's just all these different countries. Or to go back to the states analogy, there are just these counties that are assembled into this order. And on an individual level, there can be a truth, but not an overall arching system.
Well, I mean, I think she would be saying that at the bottom, there is no universal truth. Okay. So that maybe you might have, like that there's no, there's no fundamental basis of political organization from what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can use political organization to reckon countries, states, counties and stuff, and it all works well enough at those levels, but there is no bottom of political organization. There's no fundamental unit of it that is perfectly real.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm not saying I'd buy her take on it, but I can see how it would, I see how it lines up.
Yeah. And I do think it's interesting. I'm not saying I'm convinced by her point of view. I just think it's an interesting idea.
Well, yeah. And to your point that we laid out at the beginning, it's a non-magical
right.
Version of this. Like certainly we can look to to various examples where someone, isn't buying into it for supernatural reasons, but she has a scientific theory here.
Yeah. And so,
let's say it's at least a non-supernatural theory.
And it participates inductively. And so,
right,
because
yes.
It looks at like, well, this has been the case in some of our study of science. We keep finding out that stuff that we think accurately describes the world is not really perfectly accurate. It's just accurate enough.
Okay.
Anyway. That's what I got. So, Robert, are you convinced? What do you think? Are you reductionist, emergentist, somewhere in between? One of those qualified middle grounds?
Oh, I guess I've got to fall back on the sort of lens-based view of it. You know, I can put the lens of reductionism and the lens of emergence on as needed, and certainly see how they line up with reality. But yeah, I mean, I certainly think emergence carries a lot of weight.
Yeah, I certainly intuitively feel that sense of emergence. But then again, I also, when I get thinking in the reductionist mindset, that can make sense to me too. I guess I'm just very impressionable. I don't know what to think about this. I do think it's a really interesting subject though. And I do think it's important always to come back to the kind of stuff we're doing here where we pay attention not just to how science is done, but to the assumptions underpinning it.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, hey, if you want to find out more about this topic, other related topics that deal with sort of the nature of science and the nature of scientific inquiry, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, videos, blog posts, links out to various social media accounts such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, etc. And hey, there's even an old-fashioned way to get in touch with us as well.
You're right. You can email us, as always, at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.